You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is Jamie Flotis. Jamie is with the El Paso Holocaust Museum and Study Center. She's going to talk with us about the center, also about something that's going on today and upcoming events as well. Jamie, thank you very much for being with us, and welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the El Paso Holocaust Museum and Study Center for people who may not be aware of the center and perhaps even a history of how you all came about.
Absolutely. Well, El Paso Holocaust Museum and Study Center has been part of the El Paso community since 1984. We were started by a Holocaust survivor, Henry Kellen, whose vision was really to educate El Paso and the surrounding community about the Holocaust in memory of his family and all that he lost during that time. So we exist today because of that amazing man. We are located downtown in the museum district, and we really emphasize education, social awareness, tolerance, and acceptance, and we teach those lessons through the history of the Holocaust.
You and I were discussing before the program started about an article that I read in the Jerusalem Post, and as you mentioned, the museum here in El Paso was started because of the generosity of a Holocaust survivor and how he wanted to keep that alive, to make people aware of what was going on. And it's sad to think now that as some of those survivors begin to pass on, it seems like the Holocaust has gone by the wayside as far as teaching people. And the article in the Jerusalem Post mentions that 2/3 of millennials aren't even aware of the Holocaust.
Absolutely. And those figures are staggering to us at the museum and to all educators in this field. It is hard even to wrap our heads around that it is becoming a history that is not seen as relevant or as deserving the time in the classroom as other things. The Holocaust was such a pivotal moment in history, and the tragedy of that event does not ever diminish despite the passage of time. But it just makes what we do at the museum and at other centers even more important because as we're seeing more and more young people in particular are not necessarily seeing the importance of studying the Holocaust or really are not seeing the application to their lives. But we are seeing many, many things in our news, in our world events that are very similar to what happened during the Holocaust. We're seeing neo-Nazi marches. We're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism throughout the world, even in the United States. The hatred, bullying, bigotry, those things are not going away. And it is becoming more and more apparent to us that history is repeating itself.
Now, it's hard to believe that in this article in the Jerusalem Post, it cites Steven Spielberg, who was a director of Schindler's List. And it's hard to believe that that movie came out 25 years ago.
It is. The passage of time is unbelievable. It has been 25 years. And when that movie came out, it was it really was such a pivotal film. It showed so much about the Holocaust that many people had not known before. It was, for many here in El Paso, a mandatory movie to see. Our founder, Henry Kellen, paid for many, many students to go and see that film because of its importance to Holocaust education. And what Steven Spielberg has done since then has been tremendous in the field of education.
One of the things that I remember from watching that film is, as you exited the theater, and you know, when you go to the movies, the lobby, you can hear a lot of people talking and laughing. When we left the theater, it was silent everywhere. Everyone was so quiet.
Oh, absolutely. I will never forget the first time I saw that film. It has stayed with me ever since then. But it's not a film that is used as much in classrooms today. When I ask students who I give tours to at the museum if they've seen it or if they've even heard of it, many have not. And that is a bit of a depressing fact as well because of what an important film it is.
Now, the study center, as the name implies, is a study center. So
yes.
Obviously you have lessons, courses, different things to teach the students and the visitors. Tell us how you all work with teachers and what are some of the things that you offer them.
Okay. Well, one of our biggest teaching tools at the museum are guided tours. And we do a lot of outreach to our teachers throughout El Paso and the surrounding area to encourage them to bring their students to the museum. The museum itself is laid out in a way that it really brings the history to life. And it ties in a lot of stories from our local survivors to really personalize that history. And in my opinion, nothing really replaces a tour of the museum for students because of how visual and how personal it makes the history of the Holocaust. So it doesn't feel like a dry history lesson of 70-year-old history. We also do other outreaches as well for teachers because not everyone can come to the museum. So we send out curriculum trunks that have classroom sets of books, films, visual aids, so a teacher can have the resources they need right there in the classroom. And then we also send out staff members, tour guides to the classroom to give presentations to students and try to bring a bit of the museum to them.
And as far as books that you have available, you have books for adults as well as young adults?
Yes. Yes. We try to reach all age ranges. We even have books for very young students that talk about bullying and acceptance, things along those lines. And then it goes all the way up to adults.
I'm glad you mentioned that because this is something that has become a growing concern among parents and teachers, and especially cyberbullying on the internet.
Oh, absolutely. That's almost an epidemic that we're seeing right now is cyberbullying. And that's something that we talk a lot about at the museum for all students, but especially young students, because we feel that if we can reach them at a young age, that hopefully those lessons will stick with them. That's what our summer camp is all about, is teaching those lessons of acceptance and treating others the way you would like to be treated, not seeing differences in one another or celebrating those differences rather than using them as means for bullying.
I mentioned the fact that you all have various events throughout the year, and we'll get back to talking a little bit more about the history and some of the other things you offer, but tell us about what's going on today.
Well, today we are having our second installment of our Creative Activism Youth Workshops. The title for this particular workshop is The Power of Protest. And the mission for these workshops, which we do once a year, is to empower young people to stand up and speak out about things that they feel passionate about things that they see that are unjust, or places where they want to make a difference. And we try to be that avenue to give them a voice, to make them feel that they are heard and that one person can make a difference.
And what do people need to know or find out about getting involved in something like today's activities?
Well, we do these about once or twice a year. We keep those on our Facebook, on our website. We try to publicize it that way. But really, it's if you have an interest, if it's something that appeals to you, you can stop by. You can check out our publicity to see when those events are. And anybody is welcome to join. These particular workshops are geared toward high school students, but we have many other events that are for really all age groups.
An example of what's happening today in the world with, you know, students marching and especially what happened in Florida with the shooting and how the students got so involved. So tell us what you tell the high school students when they get out there as far as what to do, because people might say, well, you know, I'm not sure what's going on and how do I make my voice heard to the community and communities?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we actually start off the day referring back to history, because that's what we do at the museum. And we try to give them historic examples of young people who, in very difficult situations, stood up and spoke out about something that mattered to them. And then we show them how effective that was. So, for example, this particular workshop is done in conjunction with a new traveling exhibit that we have called The White Rose Resistance. And it is an exhibit completely about young people, young students who rose up against Hitler and during the Holocaust and used their words, used secret leaflets that they created and distributed across Germany, decrying what he was doing, speaking out against the government, the persecution of the Jews, and they used their words to try to inspire others to join their resistance and to speak out against this this man who was committing such atrocities and really, in their words, destroying the country. So the White Rose took courageous action to do this, and they paid for it with their lives. And they did it knowing that this was a possible outcome, but doing it anyway. So we use that as our foundation for this workshop, and we give the students, we're giving them a very in-depth tour of that exhibit and allowing them to explore what those lessons are, what those takeaways are. And then the afternoon we are spending with these students, we are asking them to talk about protests today, talk about how they feel protest is effective today, what they see as an important issue to them, and what is most effective in a protest. Is it sit-in? Is it is it moments of silence? Is it marching on Washington? And we want them to actually tell us what they think is important and how they see protest being acted out and what they see as most effective.
The exhibit that you mentioned is a traveling exhibit. So to take advantage of this, do schools or groups need to contact you, or how does this exhibit work?
Yes. Well, this exhibit will be part of any guided tour of the museum. We will have it from May to June. And any tour that schedules, we will include this exhibit in that tour of the museum proper. So they'll get a tour of the general galleries in the museum and then the White Rose exhibit as well. And if anyone wants to see just the exhibit alone as a guided tour, they can contact the museum as well. And then any visitor who comes into the museum can see it as a self-guided tour also.
Tell us a little bit about some of the other events that, because at the beginning you mentioned about summer camps, and you know, before you know it, summer is going to be here. It's already May, and people are going to wonder, gosh, there's so many things to do, but there's something that perhaps I can enroll my child or a person wants to be involved in something during the summer besides, you know, going fishing or
right.
hiking or whatever they do in the summer.
Absolutely. Well, one of the programs we have this summer, it's July 9th to the 13th. It's a summer camp or summer program for young people ages 8 to 12. And this is a half-day program, Monday through Friday. We go from 9 to 12. And during that time, young people will learn. They learn about the Holocaust, but in a very age-appropriate way, by us focusing on the heroes of the Holocaust, people who took those courageous actions like the White Rose, who resisted, who stood up for other people, those who helped save others, really those very positive and hopeful stories in such a difficult time. So we want them to learn the history, but we don't want them to be traumatized by the real horrors of it. So we take that more those more positive stories, and we use those as lessons for things happening today. As I said, lessons on bullying, on standing up for what is right, like this creative activism with the protesting, because we really think that no matter what the age is, a person can make a difference and can stand up for somebody else and make their mark on the world. And that's what we try to impart on our young people, that they are empowered to do something to make a difference.
And is there a cap as far as number of people allowed in these camps?
We don't necessarily have one. Usually our camp is about 20 to 25 people, and that's kind of our sweet spot because of the size of the museum and our number of staff and volunteers. But you know, if we get a really big number, then we'll take it.
And do you have another camp offered in August, or is it July the one that...
July is our only one right now. We have a few other events going on in August, so our summer that one summer camp is our only one.
So why don't you share with us what's going on in August?
Absolutely. So we have our annual Tour de Tolerance, and that is August 26th, which is a Sunday. And we have been doing this event. I believe this is now going to be our 14th year of the Tour de Tolerance. It's a bike ride and a 5K run or walk, and it is to raise money for the museum.
And this is something that, of course, you do year-round, not the Tour the Tolerance, but other events, because, as you mentioned, the museum relies on donations and volunteers to finish.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In fact, we just finished a fundraiser last week. It was our annual golf tournament, which is another fundraiser that we do. throughout the year, we have to do these fundraisers because, well, one, it raises awareness of the museum and our mission, which we take very seriously. But we also have to keep our doors open, and we never want to charge for a program or for admission to the museum. Every kind of outreach that we do, every program is completely free, and these fundraisers help us to do that.
Why don't you share with us, because I think the last time you were with us, you were talking about an event that was happening at one of the synagogues for people would start talking amongst each other's and total strangers because they weren't going to be seated with someone they knew, and you were going to try and get the conversation flowing so that they could get to know each other and talk about what's going on in the community and the world.
Yes, that is our Community Encounters event. That is another event where we are trying to break through barriers and build bridges in the community, get people to mingle and talk to each other where they may have never even met before. And that event, we do that twice a year. We begin and end the year with it. So that will not be until November, but we're already trying to get attention on that event and drum up more participation. It's a fantastic event where people have dinner together, they have conversation about events or issues that matter to everybody. Our last one was on stereotypes and how that affects every single person in one way or another. And that the outcome of that was deeper ties in the community, bridges across divides. We sat people together who had never met. So we had people of all different backgrounds, religious backgrounds, racial ethnicities. It was a fantastic way to see how similar we all are, how many issues we all care about and have similarities with one another, and also a way to celebrate differences that we have in our community as well.
And it's interesting because what you just mentioned earlier, what it was all about, stereotyping, how just by looking at someone, the way they're dressed, the kind of music they listen to, what kind of car they drive, we tend to form these stereotypes, and they're very hard to remove sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something very big that we stress at the museum because of the historic lesson that we can see from that stereotypes are very dangerous. We can see them in the Holocaust, that the stereotyping against the Jews was extremely destructive and really caused this division between Jews and non-Jews. And we see that all the time today, and we see it throughout history. When we allow ourselves to buy into stereotypes, we allow ourselves to see someone as an other, as someone different from us. And if they are different, then they are maybe not as equal or do not deserve the same type of treatment. And there's so much of that occurring in our society today, and it's a very dangerous road to be on.
Jamie, if you wouldn't mind taking us perhaps on a radio tour of the museum for people who may never have been to the museum, perhaps they're visiting and they want to go visit it. Why don't you take us on a tour?
Absolutely. Well, the museum begins with a look at what life was like before the Holocaust happened. The Holocaust didn't just occur. It wasn't this inevitable event. There were thousands of years of history that led up to this. So we talk about that road to anti-Semitism, that longest hatred is what we call it, and how that ultimately does lead up to the Holocaust. But we also look at what life was like for the Jews in Europe before Hitler came into power, the normalcy of their lives, how integrated they were in every part of society, so that when Hitler and the Nazis came into power and removed that protection they had as German citizens, it really opened the door for what happens later. And we also tie in the stories of our local survivors, those who made their homes in El Paso after the Holocaust was over. And in that way, we personalize each event that we're talking about by saying how it affected people that they may know, they may be neighbors with or friends with, or they may have met them in synagogue, because we want those personal ties. The museum then goes into the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party and how that even came about, what events led to that upheaval of the government, and then what events transpired after. The propaganda that was used by Hitler and the Nazis, the stereotyping, the Nuremberg laws, which were hundreds of laws enacted over a few short years against the Jews of Germany, the takeover of countries after 1939, starting with Poland, and then the takeover of those Jewish populations in each country. And we really examined that almost snowball effect, that progression of hatred, of anti-Semitism, of oppression, and how the Nazis systematically destroyed entire Jewish communities across Europe. And how they used other everyday citizens, how they used governments, how they used military, all different structures of society to accomplish this. It also goes into what happens with the ghettos, the final solution, which were the concentration and killing centers, and then into the rescue, resistance, and liberation is how our galleries play out.
Now, you mentioned the fact that it was started through the help of a Holocaust survivor, Mr. Henry Kellen. Tell us a little bit about what's inside the museum, because people who have been perhaps to other Holocaust museums don't know that there are pictures there, there are artifacts. And so did some of these survivors donate some of their belongings to the museum?
Yes. Yes, we do have several artifacts that belong to some of our survivors. Henry Kellen actually donated the clothes that he and his family members wore while they were in the ghetto and then in hiding. We have other artifacts similar to that as well. Yellow stars that belong to some of our survivors, paperwork, visas, and passports that belong to them. So we have many of those personal artifacts. We also have artifacts that were donated by liberators. Because of where we are in our connection to Fort Bliss, we have received, over the course of many years, we've received many artifacts, primarily Nazi regalia that was brought back by Allied soldiers as they had conquered Germany. Many of them took back souvenirs of armbands or flags or things like that, and then eventually donated them to the museum, or their family members found them in an attic and then donated them to the museum.
In some instances, what I've heard are that some of the survivors, their families, perhaps not their children, but the children of the children, may not even know all the details because the survivor doesn't even want to talk about it.
Oh, absolutely. I think that is a very common occurrence, particularly with second-generation survivors, which are the children of survivors. From what I understand from talking to many of them, is that their parents did not want to speak on their experiences. Once they came to America, they wanted to assimilate. They wanted to be Americans. They didn't want to be defined by their experience during the Holocaust and the tragedy of it, the pain of that loss, as many of them did not have their families anymore after that time. Forced many of them to stay very quiet about their experiences until older age, until their grandchildren expressed interest. That's what we find very, very often, is that survivors did not necessarily tell their children, but they told their grandchildren, because it was one generation removed. It was maybe safer to tell them. They felt that they could entrust that information to them, and that it was, I'm not sure if it was less traumatizing to them at the time to be able to tell a grandchild, or if it felt that this was the last chance to explain their experiences. But many survivors have never talked about it. Many of our liberators have never told the story of what they saw when they came into the camps. That pain and reliving that has caused many people to stay silent.
You would mention liberators, and sometimes when you see documentaries or films about the Holocaust, and when the American soldiers go into the camps, especially in the film Band of Brothers, you see what a powerful image it is. Even if they're not saying anything, the expression on their faces and the prisoners going up and giving them hugs and weeping openly, and it's just so powerful.
Oh, absolutely. And a few of our liberators who do speak on those experiences speak on how surprised, how shocked they were when they came into the camps. They had heard rumors of detention facilities or things along those lines, but no one could have expected what they saw when they opened those gates, and those few remaining survivors who were really barely alive is what greeted them. The starvation, the disease, the just a mass atrocities. One of our liberators describes what he saw as bodies being stacked like cordwood, like they had no meaning, they had no significance, they were just bodies. And that stayed with him for his whole life because of how staggering that was. The reaction of those survivors who met them at the gates was of gratitude, of disbelief. I think a lot, from what I've read, many people were in complete shock that this time it was finally over, that they were finally free.
And there was no language barrier, because even if the soldiers couldn't speak Polish or German, whatever, the fact that what they saw, the body language, said everything.
Oh, absolutely. Some things transcend language. We have heard some accounts, too, of soldiers who did speak German or spoke some of the languages, but oftentimes the communication was just touch and handing out food or blankets or just that human contact was much more powerful than the words.
Why don't you let us know a little bit about, because we mentioned volunteers and fundraisers earlier. If someone wants to volunteer, I would imagine that you would have to also train them as docents if they're going to do that?
Yes. If anyone wants to train as a docent, or which is a tour guide, we do have a training program to do that. It's a lot of history. It's a little bit of an overwhelming thing at first, but we get you ready for it with a training program, with shadowing other tours, with required readings to get anybody up to speed who wants to be a docent. And that is something we are always looking for. We have about 6,000 students who come through the museum on guided tours, and only about 15 docents to cover all those tours. So we are always looking for more people who are interested and committed and willing to give that time and energy to young people to learn about this history.
The museum itself, would you mind giving us the hours and when it's open?
Of course. It's open Tuesday through Sunday. Tuesday through Friday, we're open from 9 to 5. And Saturdays and Sundays, we are open from 1 to 5. We are only closed on Mondays.
And as far as films, anything like that, is that part of the tour itself?
We do have films that play throughout the museum. They are educational overviews of each gallery, and those are played in each gallery.
We talked about this before on another visit you had with us, but the museum itself, it was difficult to start up at first because where you were meeting first and you had that museum, there was a fire that destroyed it, correct?
Yes. Yes, we actually started out as a one-room display with a few artifacts and photographs that Mr. Kellen had. It eventually grew into a freestanding museum in the early 90s, but that museum did burn down in 2001. That was connected to the Jewish Federation on Wallenberg, and that tragically did burn down in October of 2001. But because of the outpouring of this community, they were able to build a new facility, which opened in 2008. And that's where we are currently, in the downtown location.
Jamie, if you wouldn't mind giving us a phone number or a website that people can go to find out more about the museum, and also if they want to take part in perhaps the summer camp you talked about.
Of course. Our phone number is 915-351-0048. And our website is ElPasoHolocaustMuseum.org.
That number again is 351-0048 or ElPasoHolocaustMuseum.org. Jamie, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Louie. It's been a pleasure.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louie Sines.